Maclise watched her lips pressed together. They were all he could see of her face. "I offer you a fair bargain," he said. "I will leave here tonight and say nothing of your involvement with Sulliard. In exchange for my silence, you will bring me blood and scale from your dragon." She moved like a bird taking wing. Suddenly a keen-edged blade was pressed against his throat. "Blood," she whispered, "and scale." Her hand was shaking. Instinct screamed at Niclaes to recoil, but he found himself anchored in place. "You would have me mutilate a dragon. Defile the flesh of a god," the dragon rider said. He could see her eyes now, and they cut deeper than her blade. "The authorities will do worse to you than beheading. You will be burned alive. The water in you is too polluted to cleanse." "I wonder if they will burn you for your crimes. Abetting a trespasser, contempt of the seaman, putting the whole of Psyche at risk." Niclaes gritted his teeth when her knife bit into his neck. "Sulliard will confirm what I say. He remembered your face in great detail, I'm afraid, down to that scar of yours. No one listened, of course, but if I join my voice to his..." She was shivering now. "So," she said, "you are threatening me." She withdrew the knife. "But not to save Sulliard. You use the suffering of others for your own gain. You are a servant of the Nameless One." "Oh, nothing as exciting as that, Lady Tanning. Just a lonely old man trying to get off this island so I can die in my own country." Warmth dampened his collar. "I understand you may need some time to obtain what I need. I will be on this beach 4 days from now at dusk. If you do not come, I advise you to leave Ganura with all speed." He bowed deeply and left her there, alone, beneath the stars. The sun welled up like blood from a wound. Tanny sat on the cliff that overlooked Ganura Bay, watching the waves shatter into white crystal on the rocks below. Her shoulder throbbed where Tarosa had sliced into it. She drank the wine she had taken from the kitchens, and it burned her from the roof of her mouth to her chest. These were her last hours as Lady Tanne of Clan Medushi. Only a few days after receiving her new name, she would be stripped of it. Tanne traced the scar on her cheek, the scar that had made her memorable to Sulliard, the scar from saving Sousa. It was not her only scar. She had another, deeper mark on her side. She had no memory of receiving that one. She thought of Sousa, languishing in jail. And then she thought of what Roos wanted her to do, and her stomach flopped like a fish on dry land. Even disfiguring an image of a dragon was forbidden on pain of death. To steal the blood and armor of a god was more than criminal. There were pirates who used Firecloud to put dragons to sleep, haul them into stolen treasure ships, and strip them of everything they could sell on the shadow market in Kawante, from their teeth to their blubber under their scales. It was the gravest of all crimes in the East, and past warlords had been known to punish those involved with brutal public executions. She would have no part in that cruelty. After all the battles Naimathan must have fought in the Great Sorrow, all the scars she already had, Tanne would not mutilate her so. Whatever Roos wanted with her sacred blood, it did not bode well for Psyche. And yet, she could not gamble with Sousa's life, not when she had been the one to drag her friend into this morass. Tanne scraped her fingers over her scalp, pulling at her hair in the way she sometimes had when she was younger. Her teachers had always slapped her hand to stop her. No, she would not do what Roos wanted. She would go to the Sea General and confess what she had done. It would cost her Naimathan and her place among the riders. It would cost her everything she had worked for since she was a child. But it was what she deserved, and it might save her only friend from the sword. Tanne? She looked up. Naimathan was drifting at the edge of the cliff. Her crown pulsed with light. "Great Naimathan," Tanne rasped. Naimathan tilted her head. Her body drifted with the wind as though she were as light as paper. Tanne placed her hands in front of her and pressed her brow into the ground. "You did not come to the grieving orphan tonight," Naimathan said. "Forgive me." Since she could not touch the dragon, Tanne signed the words with her hand as she spoke them. "I cannot see you any more. Truly, great Naimathan, I am sorry." Her voice was breaking, like rotted wood under strain. I must go to the honored sea general. I have something to confess. I would like you to fly with me, Tane. We will talk about what troubles you.
I would dishonor you.
Do you also disobey me, child of flesh? Those eyes were blazing rings of fire, and that mouthful of teeth invited no argument. Tane could not disobey a god. Her body was a vessel of water, and all the water was theirs. It was dangerous, but possible to ride on dragonback without a saddle. She rose and stepped towards the edge of the cliff. Shivers flickered up her sides as Nyarlathotep lowered her head, allowing Tane to grip her mane, plant a boot on her neck, and sit astride her. Nyarlathotep flowed away from the castle and dived. A thrill sang through Tane as they plummeted towards the sea. She could not breathe for dread and joy. It was as if her heart had been hooked from her mouth, caught like a fish on a line. A spine of rocks rushed up to meet them. The wind roared in her ears. Just before they hit the water, instinct pushed her head down. The impact almost unseated her. Water flooded her mouth and nose. Her thighs ached, and her fingers cramped with the effort of holding on as Nyarlathotep swam, tail sweeping, legs clawing, graceful as a black fish. Tane forced her eyes open. Her shoulder burned with the healing fire only the sea could light. Bubbles drifted like sea moons around her. Nyarlathotep broke the surface, and Tane followed.
Up, Nyarlathotep said, or down?
Up. Scale and muscle flexed beneath Tane. She tightened her hands in the slick of mane. With one great leap, Nyarlathotep was high over the bay, raining water down upon the waves. Tane turned to see over her shoulder. Ginnura was already far below. It looked like a painting, real and unreal, a floating world on the verge of the sea. She felt alive, truly alive, as if she had never breathed until now. Here, she was no longer Lady Tane of Clan Medushi, or anyone at all. She was faceless in the gloaming, a breath of wind over the sea. This was what her death would feel like. Jeweled turtles would come to escort her spirit to the Palace of Many Pearls, and her body would be given to the waves. All that would be left of it was foam. At least, that's what would have happened if she had not transgressed. Only riders could rest with their dragons. Instead, she would haunt the ocean for eternity. The drink was heavy in her blood. Nyarlathotep soared higher, singing in an ancient language. The breath of both human and dragon came like cloud. The sea was vast below them. Tane nestled into Nyarlathotep's mane, where the wind could hardly touch her. Countless stars glistened above, crystal clear without cloud to obscure them. Eyes of dragons never born. When she slept, she dreamed of them, an army falling from the skies to drive away the shadows. She dreamed she was small as a seedling, and that all her hopes grew branches like a tree. She stirred, warm and listless, with a light ache in her temples. It took her some time to wake fully, so deep was she in dreaming. As she remembered everything, her skin turned cold again, and she realized she was lying upon rock. She rolled onto her hip. In the darkness, she could just make out the shape of her dragon.
"Where are we, Nyarlathotep?"
Scale hissed on rock.
"Somewhere," the dragon rumbled. "Nowhere."
They were in a tidal cave. Water washed in from outside. Where it broke against the rock, pale lights bloomed and dwindled, like the tiny glowing squid that had sometimes washed up on the beaches of Cape Hisan.
"Tell me," Nyarlathotep said, "how you have dishonored us."
Tane wrapped one arm around her knees. If there was any courage left in her, there was not enough to refuse a dragon twice. She spoke softly. Nothing was secret. As she recounted everything that had happened since the outsider had blundered onto that beach, Nyarlathotep made no sound. Tane pressed her brow to the ground and waited for judgment.
"Rise," Nyarlathotep said.
Tane obeyed.
"What has happened does not dishonor me," the dragon said. "It dishonors the world."
Tane ducked her head. She had promised herself she would not cry again. "I know I cannot be forgiven, great Nyarlathotep." She kept her gaze on her boots, but her jaw trembled.
"I will go to the honored sea general in the morning. You can choose another rider.
Oh, child of flesh, you are my rider, sworn to me before the sea. And you are right that you cannot be forgiven, Nyarlathotep said, but only because there was no crime.
Tane stared up at her.
There was a crime, her voice quaked. I broke seclusion. I hid an outsider. I disobeyed the great edict.
No, a hiss echoed through the cave. West or east, north or south, it makes no difference to the fire. The threat comes from beneath, not from afar.
The dragon lay flat on the ground, so her eyes were as close as possible to Tane.
You hid the boy, spared him the sword.
I did not do it out of kindness, Tane said. I did it because... Her stomach twisted. Because I wanted my life to run a smooth course, and I thought that he would ruin it.
That disappoints me. That dishonors you. But not beyond forgiveness,
Nyarlathotep tilted her head.
Tell me, little kin, why did the Innish man come to Psyche?
He wanted to see the all-honored warlord, Tane wet her lips. He seemed desperate.
Then the warlord must see him. The Emperor of the 12 Lakes must also hear his words.
The quills on her back stiffened.
The earth will shake beneath the sea. He stirs.
Tane dared not ask what she meant.
What must I do, Nyarlathotep?
That is not the question you must ask. You must ask what we must do.
Chapter 28. South. Rorka, capital of the Aesir, was the largest remaining settlement in the south. As he threaded his way through its jumble of high-walled paths, Loth found himself at the mercy of his senses. Mounds of rainbow spices, flower gardens that perfumed the streets, tall wind catchers accented with blue glass, all of it was unlike anything he knew. In the moil of the city, only glances were spared for the Ichneumon at his side. They must not be as rare in the Aesir as they were farther north. Unlike the creature of legend, this one seemed not to be able to speak. Loth edged through the crowds. Despite the heat, he had covered himself to the neck with his cloak, but it still made panic coil in him when someone came too close. The ivory palace, seat of the House of Tamargum, loomed over the city like a silent god. Doves waft around it, carrying messages between the people of the city. Its domes shone gold and silver and bronze, as bright as the sun they mirrored, and the walls were spotless white, arched windows cut into them like patterns into lace. It was for the House of Tamargum that Chasar Uk Ispad worked as an ambassador. Loth tried to go towards the palace, but the Ichneumon had other ideas. He led Loth into a covered market, where the air was sweet as pudding.
I really don't know where you think you're going, Loth said through cracked lips.
He was sure the animal could understand him. Could we stop for water, please, sir? He might as well have held his tongue for all the good it did him. When they passed a trove of saddle flasks, each crystalline with water, he could bear it no longer. He fumbled the purse of coins from his bag. The Ichneumon looked back at him and growled.
Please, Loth said wearily.
The Ichneumon let out a huff, but sat on its haunches. Loth turned to the merchant and pointed to the smallest bottle, spun from iridescent glass. The man replied in his own tongue.
I speak no Aesiri, sir, Loth said ruefully.
Ah, you are Innish, my apologies, the merchant smiled, crinkling the corners of his eyes.
Like most Aesiris, he had golden skin and dark hair. That would be Eit sons. Loth hesitated. Being rich, he had no experience of wrangling with merchants.
That seems very expensive, he muttered, conscious of his paltry store. My family are the best glassblowers in Rorka. I can hardly taint our good name, my friend, by underselling my skills.
Very well. Loth wiped his brow, too hot to gainsay. I have seen people wearing cloths about their faces. Where can I buy one?
You came without a par. Why, you are lucky to not be sandblind.
With a click of his tongue, the merchant shook out a square of white cloth. Here,
This will be my gift to you.
You are too kind.
Loth extended a hand for the cloth. He was so afraid the plague might seep through his glove that he almost dropped it. Once the power covered all but his eyes, he gave the man a handful of the gold coins from his purse.
The dawn shines on you, friend, the merchant said.
And on you, Loth said awkwardly.
You have already been so generous, but I wonder if you could help me.
I am in the Aesir to find His Excellency, Chazar Uk Ispad, who is an ambassador to King Janta and Queen Saima. Might he be in residence at the Ivory Palace?
Ha! Huh. You will be fortunate to find him. His Excellency is often abroad, the merchant said, chuckling.
But if he is anywhere at this time of year, he will be in his estate in Rumlabar.
He handed Loth his flask.
Caravans leave from the Place of Doves at dawn.
Could I send a letter from there, too?
Of course.
Thank you. Good day to you, sir.
Loth stepped away and drained the flask in three long swallows. Panting, he wiped his mouth.
The Place of Doves, he remarked to the ichneumon.
How beautiful it sounds. Will you take me there, my friend?
The ichneumon took him to what must be the central hall of the market, where stalls offered sacks of dried rose petals, bowls of spun sugar and sapphire tea, fresh from the kettle. By the time they emerged, the sun had dipped towards the horizon and stained glass lanterns were being lit. The Place of Doves was impossible to miss. Overlaid with square pink tiles, it was surrounded by a wall that connected four towering dovecotes shaped like beehives. Loth soon worked out that the nearest was for mail heading to the west. He stepped into the cool honeycomb, where thousands of white rock doves nestled in alcoves. On his last night in Cascaro, he had written Margaret a letter, and he had an idea of how to get it past Combe. A birdkeeper took it now, along with his coin, and promised it would be sent at dawn. Weary to his bones, Loth let the ichneumon lead him from the dovecote and nudge him towards a building with the same latticework windows as the palace. Though the Ursiri woman inside could not speak Inish, they somehow conveyed to one another, by dint of fervent gesturing and jaw-breaking smiles, that he wanted to stay for one night. The ichneumon remained outside. Loth reached up to scratch between his ears.
"Do wait for me, my friend," he murmured. "I would treasure your company in another desert."
A short bark was his only answer. The last he saw of the ichneumon was its tail disappearing into an alley. Beside that alley stood a woman. She was leaning against a pillar. Her arms were folded. Her face was hidden by a bronze mask. She wore belled trousers, tucked into boots with open toes, and a thigh-length brocade coat. Unnerved by her gaze, Loth turned away and went back into the inn. He found a small room overlooking a courtyard where sweet lemon trees surrounded a pool. Dizziness wafted through him at the cloying scent. He took in the unfamiliar bed, piled with bolsters and corncockle silk, and wanted nothing but to sleep. Instead, he went to his knees beside the window, and he wept for Kitson Glade. The saint gave him slumber when he could sob no more. He woke in the small hours, puffy-eyed and aching, with a swollen bladder that wanted his attention. Once he had relieved himself, he groped his way back to his room. Thinking of Kit split his chest open. Grief was a swallow in him, draining all good thoughts. Outside, the doves had gone to roost. The burnished domes of the ivory palace drank in the lights and flickered like candles. Above them, stars wound across the darkness. He was not in the west any longer. This was a land sworn not to virtudom, but to a false prophet. Eid had confessed to finding the teachings of the Dawn Singer beautiful as a child, but Loth had shivered. He could not imagine what it must be like to live without the comfort and structure of the six virtues. He was glad she had converted when she came to court. A breeze cooled his skin. He longed for a bath, but feared the plague would poison the water. He would burn the sheets when he rose in the morning, and pay the innkeeper for her loss. Fire itched along his back. His hands were becoming scaled, and he could only wear gloves for so long without raising suspicions. He prayed Chazar Uk Ispad would indeed have the cure. The Knight of Fellowship had sent the ichneumon to him. He could not be meant to die that way. He slept again, dreamlessly, until he was awake. His limbs were shaking uncontrollably. Fever roared through him, but he was certain something else had made him stir. He fumbled for his sword, only to remember it was lost. "Who is that?" He tasted salt on his lips. "Iad." A shadow moved into the moonlight. A bronze mask loomed over him, and then all was dark.
Chapter 29. East. Rain was falling on the capital again. Tane knelt at her table in her private rooms at Saltflower Castle. After her confession, Nyarlathotep had delivered her to the castle where she remained. The dragon had said she would return to Cape Hisan for Sulliard. If he had the protection of a god, his petition would have to be heard at court. Nyarlathotep would also order that Susa be released at once from the jailhouse. They were to meet on the beach at sunrise, and then go together to the sea general to tell him everything. Tane tried to eat her supper, but her hands shook. Most of the dragon riders had been called away to assist the High Sea Guard in the coastal settlement of Sidupi. The fleet of the Tiger Eye had attacked with 100-strong force of pirates who were looting at will. She called for tea. It was brought to her by one of her personal attendants, who now stood close to serve her when she needed it. Her bedchamber in the inner quarter was more beautiful than she had ever dreamed it would be, with a coffered lattice ceiling and sweet-smelling mats. Gold foil shone from the ornately painted walls, and the softest of bedding was waiting to embrace her. At the heart of all this finery, she could not eat or sleep. Her hands shook as she finished the tea. If she could only sleep, Nyarlathotep would be there when she woke up. Tane had taken one step towards the bedding when the floor shunted and thunder rolled beneath the castle. She pitched into the wall. The force of the quake knocked her legs from under her, sprawling her across the mats. The lantern flickered. Three of her attendants came running into the chamber. One of them knelt beside her while the others took her by the elbow and lifted her to her feet. She gasped when she put weight on her left ankle, and they hurried her to the bedding. "Lady Tane, are you hurt?" "A sprain," Tane said, nothing more.
"We will bring you something for your pain," the youngest attendant said. "Wait here, honored Medushi."
The three of them retreated. Distant, confused shouts drifted through the open window. Earthshakes did happen in Psyche, but there had not been one in a long time. The attendants brought her a bowl of ice. Tane wrapped some in cloth and pressed it to her tender ankle. The fall had kindled the pain in her shoulder and in her left side, where her old scar was. When the ice was almost melted, she blew out the lantern and lay down, trying to find a comfortable position. Her side ached as if a horse had kicked it. Even as she succumbed to sleep, it was throbbing like a second heart. A knock jolted her awake. For a moment, she thought she was back in the South House, late for her class. "Lady Tane?" It was not the voice of any of her attendants. The pain in her side was raging now. Blear-eyed, she rose, trying not to jar her ankle. Six masked foot soldiers waited outside her room. All wore the green tunics of the land army. "Lady Tane," one of them said with a bow, "forgive us for disturbing you, but you must come with us at once." It was unusual for any soldier of the land army to set foot in Saltflower Castle.
"It is the middle of the night," Tane tried to sound imperious. "Who summons me, honorable soldier?"
"The honored governor of Ginnura,
the most powerful official in the region. Chief magistrate of Psyche, responsible for administrating justice to those of high rank." Tane was suddenly aware of every drop of blood in her veins. Her body felt untethered from the ground, and her mind gleamed with terrible possibilities, the foremost being that Roos had already gone to the authorities. Perhaps it was best to go softly, to play innocent. If she ran now, they would consider it an admission of her guilt. Nyarlathotep would be back soon. Whatever happened, wherever she was taken, her dragon would come for her.
"Very well."
The soldier relaxed his stance.
"Thank you, Lady Tane. We will send your servants to help you dress."
Her attendants bought her uniform. They lifted the surcoat onto her shoulders and tied a blue sash around her waist. As soon as she was dressed and they turned their backs to leave, she took a blade from under her pillow and slipped it into her sleeve. The soldiers escorted her down the corridor. Every time her left foot touched the floor, pain arrowed up her calf. They took her through the near-deserted castle into the night. A palanquin awaited her at the gateway. She stopped. Every instinct was telling her not to get inside.
"Lady Tane," one of the soldiers said, You cannot refuse this summons from the honored governor.
Movement caught her eye. Onrem was returning to the castle with Kampuru. Seeing Tane, they strode towards her.
As a member of Clan Medushi, Tane said to the soldier, emboldened, I believe I can do as I choose.
Deep in the eye holes of his mask, his gaze flickered. Onrem and Kampuru had reached her now.
Honorable Tane, the latter said, is something wrong?
His voice was a rasp and a ring. A sword eased from its scabbard. Faced with two more riders, the soldiers shifted their weight.
These soldiers wish to take me to White River Castle, Honorable Kampuru, Tane said. They cannot tell me why I am summoned.
Kampuru looked at the captain with a wrinkle in his brow. He was almost a head taller than all the soldiers.
By what right do you summon a dragon rider without warning? He asked.
Lady Tane is God-chosen, yet you take her from this castle as though she were a thief.
The honored sea general has been informed, Lord Kampuru.
Onrem raised her eyebrows.
Indeed, she said. I will be sure to confirm that with him when he returns.
The soldiers said nothing. Casting them a stern look, Onrem took Tane aside.
You must not worry, she said quietly. It will be some trivial matter. I've heard the honored governor likes to make her authority known even to Clan Medushi. She paused. Tane, you look unwell.
Tane swallowed.
If I'm not back within the hour, she said, will you send word to the great Naimathan?
Of course,
Onrem smiled.
Whatever it is will soon be resolved. See you tomorrow?
Tane nodded and tried to smile back. Onrem watched as she climbed into the palanquin, as it left the castle grounds. She was a dragon rider. There was nothing to fear. The soldiers carried her through the streets, past the evening market and under the season trees. Laughter rolled from crowded taverns. It was only when they passed the Imperial Theatre that Tane realized they were not going to White River Castle, where the honored governor of Genura lived. They were heading into the southern outskirts of the city. Fear clenched her chest. She reached for the door of the palanquin, but it was bolted from the outside.
"This is not the right way," she called. "Where are you taking me?"
No answer.
"I am a Medushi. I am the rider of the great Naimathan of the Deep Snows," her voice cracked. "How dare you treat me in this way?"
All she heard was footsteps. When the palanquin finally stopped and she saw where they were, her stomach dropped. The door unlocked and slid open.
"Honored Medushi," one of the soldiers said, "please follow me."
"You dare," Tane whispered. "You dare bring me to such a place."
A rotten smell curdled in her nostrils, sharpening her fear. She had squandered her opportunity to run. Even a dragon rider could not fight all the sentinels here, not without a sword. And in any case, there was nowhere to go. She got down from the palanquin and walked, chin raised, side throbbing with every step, hands clenched. They could not have brought her here to kill her. Not without a trial. Not without Naimathan. She was God-chosen, protected, safe. As the soldiers led her towards Genura jailhouse, the hum of insects snatched her gaze upward. Three fly-blown heads, bloated with decay, watched the streets from the gate above. Tane stared at the freshest of them, the thatch of hair taut with blood, the tongue puffy in death. His features had already slackened, but she recognized him. Salyard. She tried to keep her grip on her composure, but her spine tightened, and her stomach churned, and her mouth turned dry as salt. She had heard that far away in Innis, where the water ghost had come from, people gathered in public to witness executions. Not so in Psyche. Most of the city was unaware that in the grounds of the jailhouse, a young woman of 17 was on her knees by a ditch, her arms roped behind her back, waiting for the end. Her long hair had been shaved away. The soldiers marched Tane towards the prisoner and held her in place. An official was speaking, but she could not hear through the swash of blood in her ears. The woman had looked up at the sound of footsteps, and Tane wished she had not, for she knew her.
"No," Tane said, voice cracking. "No, I order you to stop this."
Susa stared back at her. Hope had rushed into her eyes, but now grief quenched it.
"I am God chosen," Tane screamed at the executioner. "She is under my protection. The great Naimathan will bring the sky down on your heads for this."
He might as well have been made of stone.
It was not her. It was me. It is my fault. My crime.
Susa shook her head, lips quivering. Rain beaded on her lashes.
Tane, she said thickly, look away. Susa!
Sobs clotted in her throat. It was a mistake. Stop this. Fingertips bit into her arms as she struggled. All her self-possession gone. More and more hands grasping her. Stop this. All she could see was Susa as a child, crowned with snowflakes, and her smile when Tane had taken her hand. The executioner raised his sword. When the head rolled into the ditch, Tane slid to her knees.
I will always keep you safe.
When the dragon rider did not arrive at the beach at the agreed-upon time, Nicolas generously assumed that she had been unavoidably delayed and made himself comfortable. He had brought with him a satchel containing some of his books and scrolls, including the fragment Trude had given him, which he perused by the light of the iron lantern. His pocket watch was open beside him. The clock, the modern symbol of the Knight of Temperance, a symbol of regulation, measurement, restraint. It was the virtue of dullards, but also of scholars and philosophers who believed it encouraged self-examination and the pursuit of wisdom. Certainly it was the closest of the six virtues to rational thought. It should have been his patron virtue. Instead, on his 12th birthday, he had chosen the Knight of Courage. His brooch now rusted somewhere in Brigstad. He had torn it off the day he was exiled. An hour passed, and then another. The truth was indisputable. Lady Tane had called his bluff. The promise of dawn was on the horizon. Nicolas snapped his watch shut. There went his chance of a glorious return to Ostendur with a freshly brewed elixir of life. Perume and Izaru would be horrified if they knew what he had asked the dragon rider to do. It made him no better than a pirate. But creating the damned elixir was the only way he would ever get home, his only potential sway with the royal houses over the abyss. He sighed. To save Sulliard, he needed to tell the warlord about Tane Bedushi and her crime against Psyche. It was what he would have done at once were he a better man. As he trudged back up the beach, he stopped. For a moment he thought the stars had been rubbed out. When he looked harder and made out the flicker of light, he froze. Something was descending. Something vast. It moved as if it was sinking through water, a banner of scarred iridescent green. A bladder-shaped organ dominated its head, glowing lambent blue. The same glow throbbed under its scales. A lacustrine dragon. Nicolas watched hungrily as it landed on the sand, graceful as a bird. A great weathered rock hunched like a shoulder from the sand. He retreated behind it, never taking his gaze off the dragon. From the way it turned its head, it was looking for something. Nicolas hunkered down and blew out his lantern. He watched as the creature snaked towards the shore, closer to his hiding place. The creature spoke.
Tane?
Its massive front legs waded into the sea. Nicolas was almost near enough to touch one of its scales, the key to his work almost at his fingertips. He stayed crouched beneath the rock, craning his neck to look. Its eyes were pinwheels.
Tane, the boy is dead, it said in Psychonese. So is your friend. It bared its teeth. Tane, where are you?
So this was her beast. The dragon sniffed, its nostrils flaring. That was when a blade chilled his throat and a hand covered his mouth. Nicolas made a muffled sound. The dragon jerked its head towards the rock. Nicolas trembled. He heard nothing of his own body, not his heartbeat or his breath, but he could picture the sword at his throat in meticulous detail. A curved blade, an edge sharp enough to spill his life if he moved a fraction of an inch. A hiss came through the night, then another, and another. The dragon let out a snarl. Claw rang against rock like sword on sword. Black smoke consumed the beach. The smell of it was acrid, like burning hair and brimstone, and gunpowder, fire cloud. Abruptly, Nicolas was wrenched to his feet. Then he was stumbling through the billows of smoke, choking on them, hauled by a figure shrouded in cloth. The sand slithered beneath his feet, sending each footstep awry.
Wait! He pointed at his captor. Wait, damn you!
A tail lashed out of the smoke and caught him a terrific blow in the gut. He was thrown back onto the sand where he lay, benumbed and winded, his eyeglasses dangling off one ear. He drifted, drunk on the black cloud,
It rushed into his nostrils and plumed out again. A mournful sound, like a dying baleen. A thud that shook the earth. He saw Janar walking barefoot on the beach, a faint smile on his lips. Jan, he breathed, but he was gone. Two booted feet pressed into the sand. Give me a reason, a voice said in Cyclonese, and I may not gut you. A bone-handled knife flashed in front of him. Do you have something to offer the fleet of the Tiger Eye? He tried to speak, but his tongue felt bee-stung. Alchemist, he wanted to say. I am an alchemist. Spare me. Someone lifted his satchel. Time splintered as scarred hands rummaged through his books and scrolls. Then the hilt of the knife clipped his temple, and a dark wave swept away his cares. Chapter 30 West Trud Ut Ziadur was imprisoned in the Dern Tower. Under threat of the rack, she had confessed to many crimes. After the royal visit had been announced, she had approached a playing company called the Servants of Verity, a so-called masterless troupe, bereft of the patronage of a noble and treated as vagabonds by the authorities. Trud had promised her own patronage and money for their families in exchange for their help. The staged attack had been intended to convince Sabran that she was in mortal danger, both from Iskallen and the Nameless One. Trud had meant to use it as grounds to petition her open negotiations with the East. It had not taken too much wit to piece together what had happened next. Those with true hatred towards the House of Berethnet had infiltrated the performance. One of those, Bess Weald, whose home in Queenside had been stuffed with pamphlets written by doomsingers, had murdered Lievelin. Several innocent members of the Servants of Verity had also been slain in the fray, along with a number of city guards, two of the Knights of the Body, and Lenora Paling, whose grief-stricken parents had already come for her. Trud might not have meant to kill anyone, but her good intentions had been for naught. Eid had already written to Chassar to tell him what had happened. The prioress would not be pleased that Sabran and her unborn child had come so close to death. Briar House was draped with the grey samite of mourning. Sabran shut herself into the privy chamber. Lievelin was laid in state in the sanctuary of Our Lady until a ship arrived to bear him home. His sister, Amuna, was to be crowned, with Princess Bedona as heir apparent. A few days after Lievelin had been taken, Eid made her way to the royal apartments. Usually, the early morning was peaceful, but she could not shake the tension in her back. Tharian Lintley had watched her take four lives during the ambush. He must have realized she was trained. She doubted anyone else had seen in that bloody clash, and it was clear Lintley had not reported her affinity for blades, but she intended to keep her head down. Easier said than done as a lady of the bedchamber, especially when the queen had also seen her kill. Iad? She turned to see a breathless Margaret, who caught her by the arm.
Isloth, her friend whispered. He sent me a letter.
What?
Come with me, quick.
Heart pounding, Iad followed her into an unused room.
How did Loth get a letter past Colm?
He sent it to a playwright Mama supports. He managed to pass it to me during the visit to Ascalon. Margaret withdrew a crumpled note from her skirts.
Look!
Eid recognized his writing at once. Her heart swelled to see it again.
Dearest M, I cannot say much for fear this note will be intercepted. Things are not as they seem in Cascaro. Kit is dead, and I fear Snow is in danger. Beware the cupbearer.
Lord Kitson is dead, Eid murmured. How? Margaret swallowed.
I pray he is mistaken, but Kit would do anything for my brother.
She touched the hand stamp. Iad, this was sent from the place of doves.
Raka,
Iad said, stunned. He left Cascaro.
Or escaped. Perhaps that was how Kit...
Margaret pointed to the last line.
Look at this. Did you not say the woman who shot Lievelin invoked a cupbearer?
Yes, Iad read the note again.
Snow is Sabran, I assume.
Aye, Loth used to call her Princess Snow when they were children, Margaret said.
But for the life of me, I cannot understand this web of intrigue. There is no official cupbearer to the Queen.
Loth was sent to find Prince Wilstan. Wilstan was investigating the death of Queen Rosarian, Iad said under her breath. Perhaps they are connected.
Perhaps, Margaret said.
Sweat dewed her brow.
Oh, Iad, I want so badly to tell Sab he is alive, but Colm will find out how I got the note.
I fear to close that door to Loth. She is mourning Leavlin. Do not give her false hope that her friend will return. He had squeezed her hand. Leave the cupbearer to me. I mean to root them out. With a deep breath, Margaret nodded. Another letter from Papa, too. She shook her head.
Mama says he is becoming agitated. He keeps saying he has something of the utmost importance to impart to the heir to Goldenbirch. Unless Loth returns. Do you think it is the mind fog?
Perhaps. Mama says I should not indulge it. I will go back soon, but not yet.
Margaret tucked the letter into her skirts.
I must go. Perhaps we can meet for supper?
Yes.
They parted ways.
It had been a terrible risk for Loth to send that note. He had meant to heed his warning. Sabran had come all too close to death in the city, but never again. Not on her watch. The pregnancy was making Sabran sick. Roslane was up with the lark to hold back her hair while she retched over a chamber pot. On some nights, Catrian would sleep beside them on a truckle bed. Still only a handful of people knew about the child. Now was not the time, in these early days of mourning. Each day, the queen would emerge from the royal bedchamber where she had spent her wedding night, looking more careworn than the day before. Each day, the shadows below her eyes seemed grimmer. On the rare occasions she talked, she was curt. So when she spoke one evening without being coaxed, Catrian almost dropped her embroidery.
"Iad," the Queen of Innis said, "you will be my bedfellow this night."
At 9 o'clock, the ladies of the bedchamber disrobed her, but for the first time, Iad also changed into her nightgown. Roslane took her to one side. "There must be light in the room all night," she told her. "Sabran will be afraid if she wakes in darkness. I find it easier to keep a candle burning on the nightstand."
Iad nodded. "I will make sure."
"Good." Roslane looked as if she wanted to say more, but refrained. Once the royal bedchamber was secured, she shepherded the other ladies in waiting out and locked the doors. Sabran was recumbent in the bed. Iad climbed in beside her and drew the coverlet over herself. For a long time, they were silent. Catrian knew how to keep Sabran in good spirits, while Roslane knew how to counsel her. Iad wondered what her role ought to be. To listen, perhaps? Or to tell her the truth? Perhaps that was what Sabran valued most. It had been years since she had slept so close to someone else. She was too aware of Sabran, the flicker of sooty lashes, the warmth of her body, the rise and sink of her breast. "I have had many nightmares of late." Her voice broke the silence. "Your remedy helped, but Dr. Bourne tells me I must take nothing while I am with child, not even sleep water." "I have no wish to contest Dr. Bourne," he had said, "but perhaps you could use the rose water in an ointment. It will soothe your skin, and may still help fend off the nightmares." Nodding, Sabran laid a hand on her belly. "I will ask for it tomorrow. Perhaps your presence will keep the nightmares at bay tonight, Iad, even if roses cannot." Her hair was unbound, parted like drapes where her shoulders peeped through. "I never thanked you for everything you did in Quiver Lane," she said. "Pained though I was, I did notice how well you fought to protect me." She lifted her chin. "Was it you who slew the other cutthroats? Are you the watcher in the night?" Her expression was impenetrable. Iad wanted to do as she had resolved, tell the truth, but the risk was too great. If word got back to Combe, she would be forced out of the court. "No, madam," she said. "Perhaps they could have protected Prince Arbrecht as I could not." "It was not your duty to protect the prince," Sabran said. Her profile was now half shadow and half gold. "It was my fault that Arbrecht is dead. You told me not to open that door." "The cutthroat would have found a way to him, that day or another day," he had said. "Somebody paid Bestwield handsomely to ensure Prince Arbrecht died. His fate was sealed." "That may be true, but I should have listened. You have never deceived me. I cannot ask Arbrecht for his forgiveness, but I will ask yours, Iad Durian." It took effort to hold her gaze. She had no idea just how greatly Iad had deceived her. "Granted," Iad said. Sabran released her breath through her nose. For the first time in 8 years, Iad felt a stab of remorse for the lie she had told. "Trude Utziadur must pay the price for her treachery, no matter her youth," Sabran stated. "By rights, I should demand that High Princess Ermuna sentences her to death.
Or perhaps you would prefer me to offer mercy, Iad, since you find its taste so comforting.
You must do as you will with her. In truth, Iad did not want the girl dead. She was a dangerous fool, and her stupidity had caused a slew of deaths. But she was 17. There was time for her to make amends. Another silence passed before the queen turned to face her. This close, Iad could see the thick black rings that surrounded her irises, dark against their startling green. "Iad," she said, "I cannot speak with Roz or Kate of this, but I will speak with you. I feel that you will think no less of me, that you will understand." Iad interlaced their fingers. "You can always speak freely to me," she said. Sabran shifted closer. Her hand was cold and delicate, the fingers bare without their jewels. She had buried her love knot ring in the sunken gardens to mark a place for a memorial. "You asked me, before I took Albrecht to consort, if I wanted to wed," she said, almost too softly to hear. "I confess, now, to you alone, that I did not, and still do not." The revelation hung between them. This was dangerous talk. With the threat of invasion, the Duke Spiritual would soon be exhorting Sabran to take another companion, even with the air inside her. "I never thought I would say those words aloud." Her breath verged on a laugh. "I know that in his face is war. I know that draconic things are waking the world over. I know that my hand would strengthen any of our existing alliances, and that the other countries of Virtudim were brought into the fold through the sacred institution of companionship." Iad nodded. "But I fear it. Why?" Sabran was still for some time. One hand sat on her belly, while Iad kept hold of the other. "Albrecht was kind to me, tender and good," she finally said, voice low in her throat. "But when he was inside me, even when I found pleasure in it, it felt..." She closed her eyes. "It felt as if my body were not wholly my own. It still feels that way now." Her gaze dipped to the barely visible bump, swathed by the silk velvet of her nightgown. "Alliances have ever been forged and strengthened through royal marriages," she said. "While Innes has the greatest navy in the West, we lack a well-trained standing army. Our population is small. If we are invaded, we will need as much support as we can muster. But each nation in Virtudim will consider itself duty-bound to defend its own shores first. A marriage, however, would come with legal stipulations, guarantees of military support." Iad kept her silence. "I have never had any great inclination towards marriage, Iad. Not the sort of marriage those of royal blood must make, born not of love, but fear of isolation," Sabran murmured. "Yet, if I refrain, the world will stand in judgment, too proud to wed my country to another, too selfish to give my daughter a father to love her if I should perish. This is how I will be seen. Who would rise in defense of such a monarch? Those who call her Sabran the Magnificent, those who saw her vanquish Fyadel, they will soon forget that deed when enemy ships darken the horizon," Sabran said. "My blood cannot deter the armies of Iskallen." Her eyes were sinking. "I do not expect you to say anything to comfort me, Iad. You have let me unburden myself, even though my fears are selfish. The damsel has granted me the child I begged of her, and all I can do is quake." Even though a fire roared in the hearth, goose flesh flecked her skin. "Where I come from," Iad said, "we would not call it selfish to do as you have done." Sabran looked at her.
"You have just lost your companion. You are carrying his child. Of course you feel vulnerable." Iad pressed her hand. "Childing is not always easy. It seems to me that this is the best-kept secret in all the world. We speak of it as though there were nothing sweeter, but the truth is more complex. No one talks openly about the difficulties, the discomfort, the uncertainty. So now you feel the weight of your condition, you believe yourself alone in it, and you have turned the blame upon yourself." At this, Sabran swallowed. "Your fear is natural," Iad held her gaze. "Let no one convince you otherwise." For the first time since the ambush, the Queen of Innes smiled. "Iad," she said, "I am not quite sure what I did without you."
Chapter 31 East White River Castle was named not for a river, but for the moat of seashells that surrounded its grounds. Behind it was the ageless forest of the wounded bird, and beyond that, the bleak and brutal Mount Tago. A year before their choosing day, all apprentices had been challenged to climb to the top of that peak, where the spirit of the great Quiriki was said to descend to bless the worthy. Of all the apprentices from the South House, Tane alone had made it to the summit. Half frozen, beset with mountain sickness, she had crawled up the last rope, retching blood onto the snow. She had not been human in that final hour, just a paper lantern, thin and wind-torn, clinging to the flickering remnants of a soul. Yet, when there was no more to climb, and she had looked up and seen nothing but the terrible beauty of the sky, she had found the strength to rise. And she had known the great Quiriki was with her, within her. At this moment, that feeling had never felt so far away. She was the tattered lantern again, barely alive. She was not sure how long they had kept her in the jailhouse. Time had become a bottomless pool. She had lain with her hands cupped over her ears, so all she could hear was the sea. Then other hands had loaded her into a palanquin. Now she was escorted past a guardhouse, into a room with a high ceiling and walls painted with scenes from the Great Sorrow, and then onto a roofed balcony. The governor of Genura dismissed her soldiers. She stood tall, her gaze crisp with distaste.
"Lady Tane," she said coolly.
Tane bowed and knelt on the mats. The title already sounded like something from another life. Outside, a sorrower called out. Its hick, 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 like a grizzling child, was said to have driven an empress mad. Tane wondered if it would break her, too, if she listened hard enough. Or perhaps her mind was already lost.
"Several days ago," the governor said, "a prisoner incriminated you in a most serious crime. He was smuggled into Psyche from Mentendon. In accordance with the great edict, he was put to death."
A head on the gate, hair stiff with blood.
"The prisoner told magistrates in Cape Hisan that when he arrived here, a woman found him on the beach. He described the scar beneath her eye."
Tane pressed her clammy palms to her thighs.
"Tell me," the governor continued, "why an apprentice with a spotless record, who was raised from nothing, who was given the rare opportunity to be God-chosen, would risk everything, including the safety of every citizen in this island, by doing this?"
It took Tane a long time to find her voice. She had left it in a blood-stained ditch.
"There were whispers that those who broke seclusion would be rewarded. Just once I wanted to be fearless, to take a risk."
She sounded nothing like herself.
"He came out of the sea."
"Why did you not report it to the authorities?"
"I thought the ceremony would not proceed. I thought the port would be closed, the gods kept out, that I would never ride."
How craven it sounded. How selfish and senseless. When she had explained it to Nyimathan, her dragon had understood. Now the shame of it was crushing.
"He seemed like a message sent from the gods." She could hardly speak. "I was too fortunate. All my life the great Quiriki was too good to me. Every day I have waited for his favor to disappear. When the outsider came, I knew it was time, but I was not ready. I had to sever his connection to me, hide him away until I had what I wanted."
All she could see was her hands, fingernails bitten raw, gnarled with faint scars.
"The great Quiriki has favored you, Lady Tane." The governor sounded almost pitying. "Had you made a different choice that night, the favor might still be yours."
The bird outside. Hick, hick, hick. A child that could never be soothed.
"Susa was innocent, honored governor," Tane said. "I forced her to help me."
"No, we interrogated the sentinel she convinced to let her into Orisima. She was a willing participant, loyal to you above Psyche."
The governor pressed her lips together.
"I am aware that a dragon requested clemency for her.
Unfortunately, the news reached me too late."
"Nyimathan," Tane whispered. "Where is she?"
That brings me to the second, even more serious matter. Close to dawn, a group of hunters landed in Genura Bay.
Hunters?
The fleet of the Tiger Eye. The great Nyamathan of the deep snows was taken.
All sensation drained from Tane. Her hands clammed into fists.
The High Sea Guard will do its utmost to retrieve her, but it is rare that our gods are spared the butchery that awaits them in Kawante.
The governor tightened her jaw for a moment.
It pains me to say it, but the great Nyamathan is most likely beyond our reach.
Tane trembled. Her stomach was a poison in her. She tried not to imagine what Nyamathan must be suffering. The thought of it was so unbearable that her vision swam and her lips quaked. She was doomed, and she had nothing and no one left to lose. Perhaps, in this final act, she could leech some of the corruption out of Psyche with her.
There is someone else involved, she said quietly. Rus, a surgeon from Orisima. He tried to blackmail me, told me to bring him dragon scales and blood for his work. He has nothing moral or good in him.
Heat pricked her eyes.
He must have helped them take the great Nyamathan. Let him hurt no other dragons. Let him face justice.
The governor considered her for some time.
Rus has been reported as missing, she finally said.
Tane stared.
He went to the beach last night, according to his friends. We think he may have escaped the island.
If Rus was with the fleet of the Tiger Eye, he was already dead. A man like him would soon cross the wrong person. It brought Tane no comfort. Her enemy was gone, but so was her dragon. So was her friend. And so was the dream she had never deserved.
I made a mistake.
It was all she had left.
A terrible mistake.
You did.
Silence gaped between them.
By rights, you should be executed, the governor told her. Your self-interest and greed could have destroyed Psyche. Out of respect for the great Nyamathan, however, and for what you could have been, I will show mercy on this day. You will live out your days on Feather Island. There, you may learn to serve the great Quiriki well.
Tane stood and bowed, and the soldiers took her back to the palanquin. She had thought she would beg or weep or ask forgiveness, but in the end, she felt nothing. Chapter 32. South. The reflection of water danced on an arched ceiling. The air was cool, but not so cool as to raise goose flesh. Loth became aware of these things shortly after realizing he was naked. He lay on a woven rug. To his right was a four-sided pool, and to his left, a recess scooped into the rock, where an oil lamp shone. Sudden pain clawed up his back. He turned onto his belly and vomited. And then it was upon him. The blood blaze. It had been a far-off nightmare in Innes, a fireside story for dark nights. Now he knew what all the world had faced in the grief of ages. He knew why the East had locked its doors. His very blood was boiling oil. He screamed into the darkness of his cauldron, and the darkness screamed back. A skep broke open somewhere inside him, and a swarm of enraged bees disgorged into his organs, setting them aflame. And as his bones cracked in the heat, as tears melted down his cheeks, all he desired in the world was to be dead. A flash of memory. Through the crimson haze, he knew he must reach the pool he had seen and douse the fire within him. He started to get up, moving as if on a bed of hot coals, but a cool hand grazed his brow.
No.
A voice spoke, a voice like sunlight.
Who are you?
His lips burned.
Lord Ataloth Beck, he said. Please, stay away. I have the plague.
Where did you find the iron box?
The Don Mata Morosa.
He shuddered.
Please.
Fear made him sob, but someone else was soon beside him, urging a jug to his lips. He drank. When he woke next, he was in a bed, though still quite naked, in the same underground chamber as before. It was a long time before he dared to move. There was no pain, and the red had vanished from his hands. Loth made the sign of the sword over his chest. The saint, in his mercy, had seen fit to spare him. He lay still for a time, listening for footsteps or voices. At last, he stood on quaking legs, so weak his head swam. His bruises from the cockatrice were coated in ointment. Even the memory of the agony was draining, but some good soul had treated him and given him their hospitality, and he meant to be